Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, you don't have to start your own business to use the principles of entrepreneurship to help you, according to our guest.
First, hundreds of Milwaukee residents showed up to voice their opinions about a federal review of the Milwaukee Police Department last night.
The U.S. Department of Justice held the hearing last night as the first step in what will be a months-long review of the Milwaukee PD's policies, training strategies, and practices.
Attendees at last night's meeting voiced a number of opinions, many of them questioning whether the review will change anything. Here's Maria Hamilton speaking. Her son, Dontre Hamilton, was killed by a police officer in 2014.
Review? What is your review going to do for the people? We need help for the United States community people.
WPR's own Chuck Cormack was at that hearing. He's a reporter based in Milwaukee, and he joins us now. Chuck, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Well, what was the tone of the hearing like last night?
Well, it was very passionate. A lot of folks there who were very upset with the police department, with days, weeks, years of mistreatment, they say, by a number of officers. And they wanted to tell their story. The hearing started a little bit late, but ran on till past 10 o'clock, which was about an hour and a half, 2 hours more than we thought it was going to last.
So to give us a bit of context here, tell us why this hearing is happening now and who requested it.
Well, Milwaukee's police chief, Ed Flynn, requested it a few months ago after the federal government suggested it wasn't going to go after Dontre Hamilton's killer, Christopher Manny, now a retired Milwaukee police officer. Manny shot Dontre Hamilton in a city park or county park in 2014 to sort of stem some of the concern over the federal government's inaction on that front. Chief Flynn requested from the Justice Department's Office of Community Oriented Policing Services, COPS, of course, that this collaborative review or collaborative reform initiative get underway. It's been tried in a few other U.S. cities, and here it is coming to Milwaukee.
So Chief Flynn requested specifically the collaborative review because there are different types of reviews.
That's right. One of the points last night and has been, well, actually was voiced when Flynn first requested this, that the collaborative review is seen as less of a probe than a pattern and practice investigation, which has gone on in other U.S. communities of police departments. The pattern and practice involves legal terms like a consent decree, making sure everybody is, you know, put it in writing, that there's going to be formal monitoring through the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Collaborative review is supposed to be not mandatory, but voluntary change, although the Justice Department repeatedly said last night that it would, you know, keep track of things and keep after the police department to make some changes.
I want to get a little more of the sound of last night. Now, here's a speaker you recorded talking about the strained relationship between the Milwaukee Police Department and minority communities.
You know, one of the things you have to realize is I'm in my 70th summer, and we've been dealing with this all my life. We looked at the opportunity for some change. So in this process, we need to have transparency.
Now, Chuck, was there any response from the Milwaukee PD last night, or was this strictly a platform for people to talk up and share their experiences?
Sure. So let me identify. That was George Martin, a longtime peace activist and community activist in Milwaukee, suggesting that you know, this thing just didn't start with the Hamilton case. There have been other shootings of individuals and other police abuses over the decades that go way back. And, you know, so he is saying let's have some transparency. There was some, often some mention last night of, well, where's the police department, where's Chief Flynn? Finally, one of the Justice Department officials said, look, we asked the police department not to be there, not to have a at least uniformed presence. There were perhaps some plainclothes folks there, but who knows, to not have a uniformed presence so that the public could have a less viewed, less oversight over what they said.
We're talking right now to WPR reporter Chuck Kornbuck, who's giving us the latest on a federal review of the Milwaukee Police Department. There was a hearing last night. A lot of citizens spoke up there. And Chuck, we talked about the different types of reviews possible. The Milwaukee Police Department is undergoing the collaborative review. There's also the pattern and practice review that other cities have had. Which other cities have undergone that sort of review?
I think there's one or two others or several others, but the collaborative review, is the issue here now, and the justice folks said, listen, things could turn into a pattern in practice at some point, but for now it's collaborative review, and they're saying that, listen, Las Vegas went through this and has made some changes. Philadelphia has been through at least some of this and has started to make some changes, at least in reductions in officer-involved shootings, which, of course, is the most deadly interaction that we've been talking about. They give this collaborative reform initiative a chance. But, again, they're saying it could turn into something more in-depth the evidence produces that, or if there's community pressure, continued calls for that, I guess.
So starting with the collaborative, and then from there, we'll see what happens. And we heard the voice of Dontre Hamilton's mother. Aside from her, what particular cases came up last night?
Well, it was Deborah Jenkins, mother of Larry Jenkins, who was shot by a police officer in 2002. Now, there were no charges in that case involving the officer, but there was that case certainly was brought forward. There were other types of things that came forward in terms of harassment, alleged harassment of citizens. A younger African-American man said, listen, I just want to come down to Water Street, go to the bars, and police keep throwing me into the paddy wagon and questioning me. I'm not doing anything wrong. I just want to enjoy, the nice parts of the city, the fun parts of the city. And there's some concern about intimidation factor. There's cases that have surfaced, of course, of Milwaukee police officers doing illegal and very invasive searches of suspects. It's all amounted to a tab well into the millions of dollars the city has had to pay. So there was also some concern last night from taxpayers saying, listen, why are we, going through these controversies and paying at the back end? If we're going to pay anything, put more into prevention, put more into police community relations, and maybe save some money and certainly save a lot of pain and embarrassment.
Were there voices speaking up last night in favor of the police department and appreciative of how they had handled things in the past?
Well, there were a few. There was somewhat controversial because a few white people that were there, and there were not white people there that spoke in favor of the reform initiative as well, but there were also some that spoke in favor of the police. Controversial because they suggested, seemed to imply that all the crime was committed by African Americans, and obviously that's not the case. And the issue is really what the police, the paid servants of the taxpayer, are doing and not who's committing various types of crime. But there was some pro-police presence from folks.
Now, as I understand it, this hearing was the first step in what could be a very long investigation. What happens next?
Well, we hear that there's going to be at least one more hearing soon. There are discussions underway. I heard that the justice folks were going to be meeting with the ACLU today. I think there's some more individual meetings and looking at police policies. But there's going to be at least one more hearing soon. There was some concern about, well, let's have this hearing before the spring primary election or the spring election. There's a mayoral race. Incumbent Tom Barrett faces three challengers here. And there's some folks that are saying, let's get more of this out before we go to the ballot box. So I think some of it will take some time. There's a window of up to 18 months before this report may be done, 8 to 10 months, beginning with policy accumulation before a report. So this is going to take a while. Again, there's some skepticism as to whether this is going to really lead to change, but for now, it's what's on stage.
Chuck, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Chuck Kornbuck giving us the latest on a federal review of the Milwaukee Police Department.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
The principles of entrepreneurship can help us in our everyday lives, according to our next guest. She says the skills and strategies that first-time business owners learn can help you in your career change or in your current position even if you're not trying to start your own business.
Adela Yamban is with us in studio. She's a program manager and new idea concierge for Idea Advance, a seed fund program for UW System faculty, staff, and student entrepreneurs. And this is a program within UW Extension's Division of Business and Entrepreneurship. Adela, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you said that the principles of entrepreneurship can help people in their careers, even if they're not entrepreneurs or have no intention of being entrepreneurs. What kinds of things are we talking about?
So I think the challenge with entrepreneurship is that we build this up as an execution issue where you need to have marketing, you need to have sales, and it is a competition of who can execute the best. And what we're learning in the world of entrepreneurship is that it's not actually, in the world of startups, it's not about how well you can execute, it's how well you can learn, how well you can adapt, how nimble you can be. And all of that comes by how well you ask questions and are you asking the right questions at the right time. And I think those same principles can be applied for anybody who's going through a career change. As a bit of a background, I was a recruiter before I came here to work for the Division of Business and Entrepreneurship. And a lot of times, a lot of my efforts were spent trying to help people consider how you retool your skills, repackage your skills in new and different ways. And one book that I would love to recommend is Business Model U by Tim Clark, Alan Smith, and Alex Osterwalder. I thought it was really great because it became less about how well do you write a resume, how well do you write your cover letter, and more about how well do you sell yourself. And people don't like that word sell, so let me rephrase and say, how well do you communicate the value that you add to that organization?
So a couple of things that you brought up there. One was asking these questions and adapting, and the other was communicating who you are and what your value is. So how does the ordinary non-entrepreneurial, say, person do that as they're approaching their job or their life?
Yeah. So I'd like to make reference to a tool that we use a lot. We use a tool called the Business Model Canvas. And what I really like about the Business Model Canvas is it breaks down these big picture concepts, sometimes abstract concepts, into really 9 key building blocks. And that, I think, is a really great way to start. I have a piece of paper here as a nice little reference for myself on the different building blocks. But there are things like who you help. We call that our customer segments, right? What value do you add? How you help, right? And we call that our value proposition. What you get. So those are the revenues and benefits. And using just coming, brainstorming those things, and then going out, this is my favorite part, going out and asking questions, that networking thing, but you're networking with intention to really get some important facts to fill in and really discover for yourself that picture of who you are and what unique value do you offer.
What kinds of questions should you be asking?
So when we advise our entrepreneurs, we first start with customer segments, right? You brainstorm, who do you think you can help? And that can be no restrictions whatsoever. And then you think about what are the activities or what kind of value do those customers expect? Part of the challenge, I think, not only in entrepreneurship, but as you're considering new moves, is you think about you. You're the central point. You really need to be thinking about others. You need to think about what others expect to see, how they expect to see it. And being able to use something like the Business Model Canvas and brainstorming these things and then going out and talking to people and asking questions about, so tell me a little bit about how your organization works. Tell me a little bit about, what types of people fit into that organization. How do you hire? Why do you hire those things? So those are very surface level questions, but you can get down into the details. I have a note here that I work with my entrepreneurs on. The big questions are, so what, who cares, and why you, right? And so if you can get a lot of details around those questions, I think that gives you a lot of information. One story that I really like is we had an entrepreneur who who had a really great idea, and she's still working on this idea, and she was going out and communicating the value proposition in a way that she thought customers would respond to. And instead, the customers gave her new language. And we taught a new language, a way for them to understand it, right? So this is what I would have advised when I was a recruiter, to help people say, you know, you're not going to go out and say, I do this, right? Perhaps the client, the company that you're applying for speaks a different language or considers the value in a different way. So being able to communicate in the way that your customer wants to hear it is the goal. And being able to have those listening sessions, going out and asking those questions, and sometimes it's not at all changing what you're delivering it, but actually changing the way you're communicating it.
We're talking with Idella Yamban right now, program manager and new idea concierge for Idea Advance, a program with UW Extension's Division of Business and Entrepreneurship, talking about how these ideas of entrepreneurship can help us in our daily life, in job searches, for example. And I suppose as we go into any sort of job, we may have assumptions about what that company wants, that hiring manager wants. How do we make sure that our assumptions are on track and that we are questioning them the right way?
Sure. So I'll go back to my favorite tool, the Business Model Canvas, because that's where you get to capture what your assumptions are. Just get those on paper, and that's when you go out and ask questions about that. So perhaps you are looking for a position, and they want somebody with a particular degree. And so maybe you talk with people in those organizations. People talk about this all the time, networking. And you might find these people in the most unique ways, right? The common suggestions are going into LinkedIn. They have a LinkedIn Pro where you can do more messaging, you know, directly messaging people. Finding people that have similar backgrounds to you. Maybe they went to the same school as you did, so on and so forth. But identifying connection points. I'm a big fan. Sometimes cold calling works just well, right? And just having a conversation and asking them about them. So when we talk to our entrepreneurs, I think the tendency is for entrepreneurs to want to talk about their product. You don't ever want to talk about your product to begin with, because you're not listening to what the customer wants when you're talking about your product. You're biasing them already. Same thing, I think. It's the same kind of principle. Now you want to talk to them about what they do, how they operate, what does a normal day look like in their world, how are these things functioning? And you'll begin to paint a picture of what is needed. And then you can begin to ask those questions of, huh, that's interesting. Well, do you need to have this particular degree to do this? Has anybody been in a role like this that didn't have this degree? Oh, come to think of it, perhaps not, because blah, blah, blah. And so now then, not only do you know that your assumption is incorrect, but they've given you language that you communicate in your resume or cover letter or whatever that actually speaks to the values that they're expecting to get.
So let's say you're someone who's looking for a job, a new job, let's say. It sounds like you should never go in saying, I am wonderful and you want me because X, Y, and Z, but you should say, what do you need? And ask a whole lot of questions before you even get to yourself.
I think when you're at the job interview, you should be selling. You should be, I hate that word, selling yourself, but you really should be communicating your value. But by that point, you should have already done the legwork to know that what you're communicating is exactly the value that they want to see out of a candidate. You shouldn't have gotten that far if you couldn't have communicated that. And to be honest with you, most of the jobs that are out there are not going to be listed on Indeed and so on. They're actually things that you get through networking. By going out and asking questions in this way, people get duped into thinking, oh, you really must be interesting. And really, you're just interested in what they have to tell you. But that's really awesome, because then that leads to a lot of opportunities that you may not have known would have existed. So this is a great way, I think, using the Business Model Canvas, capturing your assumptions, being prepared to go out and ask questions. Most importantly, listen to what people are saying, and taking those opportunities to dig deeper. That's where the real opportunities are then uncovered.
So it sounds like you're saying we actually need to have person-to-person conversations with people.
Yeah.
That it's not enough to apply for a job that you find online and then dig around on the website and hope you've got it down. You're saying you've got to do some legwork here.
Oh, my goodness. Finding a job is like getting a second job, man. It's a lot of work, right? A little anecdote is that when I was a recruiter, there were, you know, this was in that whole economic downturn, you know, 2008 to 2010 timeframe. And so a lot of people, you know, were experiencing companies that were going through massive layoffs. And you know, individuals had worked for organizations for 20 some odd years and only knew maybe their internal networks when all of that was destroyed. And so I, you know, a big task and a really big challenge, and I'm sorry to say it's not easy, but to really be constantly putting your career, you know, working on your career, doing that networking, not waiting to the last minute. And the way that I think about it in a way that's not work is that it's just going out and talking to people and hearing people's stories. Everybody has, I think, an interesting story to communicate and an interesting perspective. And if you come at it from that point of view instead of, again, me and what am I going to get out of this, it, I think, creates a more authentic relationship for people to resonate with you on.
Idella, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That was Idella Yaman, program manager and new concierge and new idea concierge for Idea Advance. That's a program with UW Extension.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Sometimes we have a lot of time to give thought to what we're going to eat for dinner. We browse through our cookbooks and we find something new and adventurous. And other times we get home late, we grab what's easiest, and a lot of times what's easiest is chicken.
We eat a lot of chicken in this country, but that doesn't mean it has to be boring. For Food Friday today, we've got one of WPR's most passionate home cooks on hand to get us re-inspired about the prospect of a chicken dinner. Noah Ovshinsky is in the studio with us. You may know him as WPR's news director. Noah, welcome back.
It is great to be here. Thanks, you both.
All right, so Noah, why chicken?
Why chicken? Where do we even start? It's good. It's okay. Really, really good, and actually a really versatile thing to cook with. And second, you know, it's popular. It's very popular.
How popular? Lots of people eating chicken?
A lot. Get this. According to Consumer Reports, we buy around 83 pounds of chicken per person annually.
A day. Oh, annually. I'm sorry.
I mean, 83
that's
pounds
a
person
a lot
per
of
capita.
Person, yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of chicken. We eat a lot of chicken in this country.
And it can be confusing. I mean, I don't eat a lot of chicken, but when I do buy chicken, there are a lot of brands out there with a lot of claims on the labels. How do you disentangle all of that when you're shopping, Noah?
Yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, the labels are confusing. It's hard to tell sometimes, you know, where the marketing actually meets reality.
So what kind of things do we see that we should maybe be skeptical about?
Yeah, so the term natural. In a Consumer Reports survey, more than half of the respondents thought that natural chickens didn't receive antibiotics. 42% thought it meant the birds were raised outdoors. And more than one-third thought that natural meant organic.
You've actually done programs or interviews on this show about how it turns out natural does not mean anything at all, almost literally in the food sense.
Yeah, drum roll, please. Natural doesn't actually mean anything. And I should add that three other labels that you might see in the grocery store are also meaningless. Free range, cage free, no hormones. First, chickens aren't commercially raised in cages, so cage free doesn't really mean anything. There is no government sanctioned definition for free range, so free range could mean literally anything. No hormones. The reality is here in this country, that's not saying much because hormones are prohibited anyway in commercial chicken production here in the United States. So the fact that you're saying no hormones doesn't distinguish it from any other chicken product because no chicken product has added hormones.
I'd be saying like no asteroids were
exactly
involved in the making of these chickens.
Right.
Okay. So
exactly.
are there words apart from the word chicken itself on a chicken package that are meaningful?
Yeah, there are a few. And when we say meaningful, here's the disclaimer. I'm simply saying they actually communicates something real about the product, right? I'm not saying it's better or worse. It just communicates something real. Organic, for instance, that's a government term, and it means that the chicken was given vegetarian feed without genetically modified organisms and certain pesticides. It also means that no antibiotics were used in the raising of those chickens. Certified humane is something you may also see. That means something. It means the chickens are raised according to guidelines from humane farm animal care, and those guidelines basically cover how the chickens are transported and how they're slaughtered. It essentially ensures that they were transported and slaughtered in as stress-free environment as possible. And then the other thing, which is quite obvious, is if it says there are no antibiotics used, assuming that you take that claim at face value, again, no antibiotics were used in the raising of those chickens, although it has to be said that if you say no antibiotics, inspections actually aren't required if you say that. So, you know, the confirmation process, it's not there.
Now, I think some consumers have gotten a little more careful about buying chicken. There have been some recalls in recent years, concerns about bacteria, things like salmonella, and yet chicken remains popular, but, you know, we treat it very carefully. What do we need to know about safety?
So on one end, yeah, chicken is really good. It's really popular. But there is some bad news. And the fact is, a lot of chicken out there has been contaminated with potentially dangerous bacteria. Just going back to Consumer Reports, they did an analysis a year or two ago that was very surprising. They bought 300 raw chicken breasts at stores across the country and found that almost all of them had potentially harmful bacteria.
So that's bad, but hopefully there's a good set. When I do cook with chicken, I cook with raw chicken, and I treat it kind of like a biohazard as I'm working with it. If I'm careful, I'm probably in good shape, right?
Exactly. The good news is it is perfectly safe if you treat it right and treat it with care. First, always cook chicken to an internal temperature of 165 degrees. This is not chicken is not steak. Chicken is not necessarily fish. Chicken is chicken.
Mm-hmm. So wait, are you saying you have a thermometer and every time you cook it, literally
yes.
You use your little
when
thermometer?
When I cook with chicken, I do. Absolutely. Huh. There's no such thing as rare chicken. There is simply properly cooked chicken, and that means 165 degrees. If there is one kitchen instrument that I recommend everybody have, not only does it make food better, it also makes it safer. That is a good food thermometer.
We're talking with Noah Oshinsky right now, one of WPR's in-house foodies, again, talking about chicken. And Noah, so you've got one of those thermometers. What else do we need to know about keeping it safe?
So actually, the other thing you really need to pay attention to, and actually more illness is related to this than actually cooking the chicken to a specific temperature, it's the issue of cross-contamination. Thoroughly wash anything that has come into contact with raw chicken in your kitchen. That includes your hands. That includes cutting boards, knives. It's when those things touch handles, utensils, and other food when trouble can really arise. And the one thing that I do in my kitchen, and I actually recommend all home cooks do, is have separate cutting boards. Mm-hmm. One for protein, and I would even separate it out. One for chicken, one for beef and seafood, and one for vegetables. And the easiest way to do it, and I know this is done in some professional kitchens, you just have them be a different color. One cutting board for red for protein and one cutting board for green, for instance, for vegetables. You just keep it separate. It's safer.
All right, we're ready to cook safely, and let's get cooking. You've got a recipe for us.
Right. So I thought long and hard, and I was thinking, you know, it's winter. I also like convenience. I think we're going to talk about something called slow cooker chicken adobo. And I cook this several times a year. The preparation is easy. It requires few ingredients, and it really spotlights the chicken. And I love the flavors.
So this is a slow cooker recipe. Where did this recipe come from?
So adobo, in this case, we're talking about what is considered really by many to be the national dish of the Philippines. It includes a protein of some kind, in this case chicken, although it could be seafood, vinegar, soy sauce, and garlic. And you essentially take those building blocks and you cook it for an extended period of time, and what you end up with is a dynamite dish.
I love cooking chicken in the slow cooker. You are using in this one skin-on, bone-in chicken thighs.
Right, because we're making what amounts to a stew, and when you make a stew or soup of any kind, including the bones in the cooking process is really important because that's where a lot of the flavor comes from. And personally, I also prefer chicken thighs. I like dark meat. And so I would highly recommend anybody who makes this recipe to really focus on thighs. You're going to get the texture, you're going to get the flavor, and it's really, it really shines if you use thighs.
So we've got a lot of other interesting stuff that must come together really well. Ginger and vinegar and soy sauce and sugar. What is that? What is that kind of marinade or sauce? Does it become a sauce, essentially?
It does become a sauce. Everything breaks down. And the interesting thing about this recipe is it uses an unholy amount of onions. Unholy amount of onions.
Is that a good
four.
Thing?
We're talking four onions.
Yeah.
Okay,
so like four medium onions, halved and thinly sliced.
That's a lot of chopping. Do you have those specialized goggles, Noah, where the onion doesn't get to your eye?
I just cry. I just let it out.
You just weep while
you're slicing
your onions.
But I weep because it's so good. But what happens is when you cook onions for, and in this case, 5 or 6 hours in a liquid, those onions really break down, and it lends a really nice flavor and texture to the stew. And I recommend, you know, serving it with rice, but you could certainly serve it with any number of other proteins, you know, potentially beans or quinoa, lentils even.
We've got this recipe for slow cooker chicken adobo on the Central Time Facebook page. So you just said, Noah, serve on rice or noodles or other grains. What do you serve alongside of it? What kind of veggies tend to go with it? Do you try to complete the Philippines theme?
I would say the one thing that I would include would be probably sour cream or yogurt. And then I would also probably chop up some fresh onions to add on as a garnish.
So we're a little light on the onion.
Yeah, I know, right? If four onions wasn't enough, get a bunch of green onions, and chop those up and add those on top of the sour cream or yogurt on the chicken adobo. It really just rounds all the flavors really nicely, and it gives it a really fresh taste. The other side benefit to all of this, in addition to tasting really good, is you have something in a slow cooker on your kitchen, cooking away for 5 or 6 hours. And so it smells really, really good.
So here's my question. I'm not a master of the slow cooker. So I would like to come home to a finished meal. Does that mean, though, that you have to get up at the crack of dawn and chop those four onions, put the chicken in there before you go to work?
Yes, but this recipe is so simple. I promise it would take you less than 10 minutes to put together all of these ingredients. There's no other preparation other than chopping, dicing, and putting it together in the slow cooker. So I've done it before work, and I've come home, and my house is smelling amazing, and I have a ready-made meal. Mm.
It's Food Friday. We're talking with one of WPR's most passionate cooks, Noah Ovshinsky. He's giving us some new ideas about what to do when we're faced with the prospect of another chicken dinner.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you have a go-to weeknight chicken recipe? And what do you cook with chicken when you want to go all out and make something really special with that chicken? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's Food Friday, and we're talking to one of WPR's most serious cooks, Noah Ovshinsky. He's giving us some fresh inspiration for what to do when you're burned out on a dinnertime mainstay, the chicken dinner.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a go-to weeknight dinner chicken recipe? What do you cook when you want to go all out? Do you have some ethnic food that chicken is a great addition to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you often cook with a whole chicken? No, this is one thing that I've done. I make them too dry. I overcook them. I don't like doing it that much. I've gone back to just individual pieces. Do you do the whole roast?
I do, but only occasionally. You know, it's often been said in the professional food business that you can tell a lot from a restaurant by how well they roast a chicken. Mm. That on one side, it seems very easy to do. But it's really not. It's really hard to do it well. And there are any number of recipes out there for people. But I think for me, a roast whole chicken is both delicious, but also something of a challenge. I use a cast iron skillet generally to cook my roast chicken. I take out the backbone and I flatten it and cook it, bake it on a very hot cast iron skillet. And if you add the chicken to an already hot skillet, you can cook it for a shorter period of time, and you'll also make sure that when you cook it, you'll cook both the dark meat and the white meat evenly. And so I highly recommend for anybody who, and actually this goes for turkey too, if you're into cooking whole chicken or whole poultry, the best thing to do is to cut the backbone out, flatten it, and then cook it. It's a lot easier, and it takes a lot less time.
So I'm probably not going to do that.
Do you do it with the Sunday chicken dinner, classic meal? You've got your whole chicken. You've got your mashed potatoes.
It doesn't present as well on
the
a table.
Gravy.
I mean, let's be honest.
A squash chicken.
A squash chicken, it doesn't present as well on a platter. But let me tell you, where you lose in aesthetics, you gain in a perfectly cooked chicken, not only a perfectly cooked chicken, but a chicken with very crispy skin, which, let's be honest, is one of the best parts about roasting a chicken.
Let's get to our callers now. We've got Ashley on the line with us in Coloma. Ashley, hi.
Hi. Our favorite quick and easy chicken is baked boneless chicken breast that we top with salsa and add a little cheese to it.
What kind of cheese?
I'm a fan of pepper jack, but my kids don't care for the spicy stuff, so we'll do cheddar for this.
Ashley, thanks a lot. That's really straightforward. Salsa can do a lot for chicken. I do that often in the crock pot for chicken tacos. In fact, if I'm in a hurry, it's just the chicken and the salsa, and that comes out pretty good. I can fancy it up. So just a nice way to bake chicken breast there, Noah. Now, chicken breast can be kind of dry. Any advice on a good baked chicken breast?
Yeah, add salsa.
Okay, there you go. You and Ashley both. Thank you so much, Ashley. That sounds great. Drop it by the studio after we're off the air.
I used to do something I would call special chicken. People made fun of me because I could only cook one thing, and it was special chicken. And it was cream of mushroom soup mixed with a little white wine and then baked with Swiss cheese on top. And it did actually taste fancier than you would think, and you didn't have the dryness issue.
Mm-hmm. Who'd you cook that for?
various people I was trying to win their favor.
Uh-huh.
And it did. It worked. Special chicken. That's a nice thing, I think, that you can get away with a lot with chicken.
The way to a man's heart is through his stomach. So.
Not necessarily chicken, but his stomach. All right, let's take another phone call. Sharon in La Crosse. Sharon, hi.
Hi. The slow cooker recipe sounds like a more delicious version of one that I do that's very, very quick. When I come home and don't have a plan, I either thaw out or take like a couple of our chicken breasts, boneless, skinless chicken breasts, put them in a pan, add, an eighth of a cup or so of soy sauce, chop up a ginger clove. My husband doesn't do onion, but I sneak in some onion flakes, and just cook it. So it sounds, put the cover on, although I do let the steam out and things, so probably 20 minutes until it's done through, and it sounds like a quick version of what the recipe you guys talked about earlier.
Yeah, it does, Sharon. Thank you for sharing that. So different, I suppose there's lots of different chicken adobos kicking around there.
There is a lot of recipes out there. As I said, it's basically the unofficial national dish of the Philippines, and it's one of those dishes that, you know, every family has, you know, a slightly different way of cooking it. But it's really a great basis for a dish, whether it's chicken, you know, seafood. You could also do this kind of treatment with other kinds of protein like beef.
One that I've been doing lately, I found online an easy chicken shawarma recipe where you cut up the chicken, marinate it for some hours, bake it for a little while first, and then sear it after baking it. It comes out great. I never have leftovers, no matter how much I make, because my family just goes to town on it. I'll find that online and put up a link on the Central Time Facebook page. It's a good and pretty easy one, by the way. Back to our callers now. Jim is online in Barron. Jim, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I love to grill chicken, and the way I grill chicken actually is to put it in a deeper pan, usually a double foil aluminum, put chicken broth on the bottom, garlic it, butter it, sometimes stuff it, and then put it on the grill, but put it on a lower temperature grill, about 300 degrees, and you basically steam it, and then about 40, 45 minutes before you're ready to eat it, I open and take the foil off and then let it brown, and it's just absolutely delicious.
And this is a whole chicken or two whole chickens we're talking about,
Jim. I usually put two whole chickens because everybody eats it so dang fast that you need two of them.
And it cooks.
Yeah, and it's delicious. Now, you can add other things. You can add a little bit of soy sauce or something to give it a little bit of different flavor, but you get the flavor of the grill, and then at the last, like I say, 40 minutes or so, you brown it, and you can add a few more coals so that it gets a little hotter, and it's brown, but it's moist.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. I have not had the courage to try to grill a whole chicken before, and you have to do that indirect heat method. You can't just have it right on the grill itself.
Yeah, you always want to cook chicken or really any protein other than maybe a steak. You want to cook it under low heat for most of the cooking and then add it to the hot side of the grill just for the last few minutes to give it the give it the sear that you want. For me, one of my favorite grilled chicken recipes is like a skewered chicken that I often make in the summer. And really, it's quite simple. What I do is I just marinate those chicken thighs with yogurt, lemon juice, feta cheese, and garlic, and let it sit and the yogurt and the feta cheese, it really lends a nice texture to the chicken after it's grilled. It essentially falls off the skewer.
But yogurt is good for that.
It's really good, and it tastes basically when you eat it, it tastes like you're on the Mediterranean coast.
You're selling me on that one. I'm curious with Jim's call, Noah, if you know how. So if you've got the broth in the bottom and it's steaming the chicken, does that mean the broth sort of infuses the chicken that's cooking with flavor?
Absolutely. It goes both ways. They infuse each other. And what it sounds like is he's basically doing something like a braise, but doing a braise on the grill, which is a great idea.
Time for one more caller. Richard is on the line in Ettrick. Richard, hi.
Hey, great show. Our favorite recipe for chicken is fennel chicken. Using a cast iron frying pan, take fennel ball, the onions, dice them up, brown them in the pan, and then once they're brown, remove them from the pan, then put in the chicken thighs, usually four or so, brown those, and then put the ingredients back together and put it in the oven at 350 for about 30, 45 minutes, and it comes out great, and serve it with white rice.
Richard, thanks so much. There's that versatility you mentioned, Noah. Fennel, I mean, is there a kind of a spice combination that wouldn't work with chicken? So, I don't know, maybe pumpkin pie spice or something. But almost any ethnicity has probably something that's going to go with chicken.
Yeah, every spice is going to give it its own character. And the great thing about chicken is it takes that spice really well, especially if you add some kind of fat to it. It'll really cover the chicken much better. You know, using some kind of oil or a fat or something will give it the kind of coverage on the chicken that you need. But chicken takes to spice and marinade really well.
Noah, thanks a lot for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That's Noah Ovshinsky, one of our in-house foodies and news director here at WPR. And again, you can find his recipe for slow cooker chicken adobo over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Monday. Monday morning after 8 on the Joy Cardine Show, Joy and her guests look at criticism of the Academy Awards for the lack of diversity in the Oscar nominations. That's Monday morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, when you ask people outside of Wisconsin what they know about Wisconsin, one of the first things they mention, apart from the Packers, is the cheese. It's a big part of the state's image.
Right, and that makes sense. We eat a lot of cheese in Wisconsin. The state has publicized that image over the years. And we learned from the Wisconsin Historical Society on this very day in 1964, Wisconsin manufactured the biggest cheese in the world, to be displayed at the World's Fair in New York. And the giant block of cheddar weighed 34,665 pounds, about 7.5 tons, by the way, and it was made in Denmark, Wisconsin.
So it was on exhibit at the fair for 5-6 months, then it went on tour, right? They trucked it around the country and people flocked because there's nothing better to do those days. They went and saw it. It was a rock star. Eventually, it did get eaten at the annual meeting of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association. At their annual meeting, it was in Eau Claire that year, evidently.
I love that the cheese went on tour like a rock band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it got eaten unlike most rock bands. So, yeah, I'm thinking, you know, mild, or call it medium cheddar. I did some numbers. You'd have to lay down about $173,000 to buy that block of cheese at a local store. And then you got to get it home. And hopefully your fridge is really, really big.
It's worth it.
It's worth it.
Well, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And then we recap the biggest news stories from around the state this week. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.